This is a talk from bethinking.org, which is UCCF's apologetic website. Apologetics is basically two things. It's the communication and the defence of the Christian gospel. So visit bethinking.org soon, and make sure you sign up as a bethinker to hear all about bethinking.org's latest releases. I feel light
in your arms. Now, over the next 2 weeks, I want to give a couple lectures to the subject of epistemology. Tonight's lecture, I want to be focused on the development of epistemology with the unfolding history of philosophy. So it's a historical overview of how various points in the history of philosophy have dealt with this particular subject. And the next week, I want to move on to the relationship between faith and reason. So here we stand back tonight and look at the historical development of the subject. Next week, we move into the nuts and bolts of it and look for ourselves at how we handle this particular subject, especially with respect to how faith and reason operate together. Now, by way of introduction, it would be right for me to define this word and this subject we're covering. Don't be afraid of long words. They won't gobble you up and eat you and hurt you. Epistemology is basically a discipline within philosophy which is concerned with the issue of knowledge. It asks, how can we come to know anything with certainty? And what are the processes involved with human knowing? And are the processes of human knowing reliable? Can we trust them? And I would say all who come to Libri have to engage with the knowledge question at one level or other. How can I know that what someone is saying in a lecture or saying at a lunch table is true? How do I handle all these knowledge claims that are thrown around this place? And for some, it's a life and death issue. How can I know with certainty that Christianity is true amidst all the competing claims within the world in which we live? Now, it's a very technical discipline within philosophy, and irritates me enormously at times. But we need to grapple with it, because epistemology is seeking to develop a theory of knowledge. That's what it's about. It seeks to show how we can claim knowledge with certainty. And I believe, actually, epistemology is a way of legitimizing philosophy. Maybe that's why some of you would love to see it fail, because you don't like philosophy. It validates the whole exercise of philosophy, because philosophy is concerned with making knowledge claims, with making propositional statements about truth and reality. So epistemology is really a way of fighting for the ongoing validity of philosophy in the face of skepticism. How can philosophy go on making knowledge claims unless it can validate the fact that now knowledge claims can be made with certainty, reliably? So tonight I want to give an overview of how philosophy has done this through history. Also, by way of introduction here, I want to say this, that the problem of knowledge comes down to what I call the gap factor, and all of us struggle with the gap factor. The gap factor is the distance between me, the subject, and all that is outside of me, which we call the object. Now, all my knowledge takes place within me. I am the subject of knowledge. So epistemology has to take the subject very, very seriously. But what I'm doing is grappling to get to grips with the reality which is outside of me. The object, that which is not me. And I believe there's a considerable gap here between me, the subject, and all that is outside of me. Or you, the subject, and all that is outside of you, all that is not you. So there's a distance right now, a considerable distance between me and all of you here. Who are you? And how can I get to know you? I always feel this at the beginning of my first tutorial with someone. The gap factor between me, the subject, and you who sits there existing separately, with an existence separate from mine. So how can I overcome this gap? Well, I can try to overcome the gap through my senses. I see you sitting there. And I ask you questions, and I hear you talking back to me. I smell you. Hopefully those are pleasant smells. They may not be. But it's another sensory way that I try to close the gap. But then I have to ask myself, are my senses reliable? And within philosophy, that's a very legitimate question. Are my senses reliable in terms of what they tell me about you? Do you see me the way that I would see me in a mirror, or another person would see me? Do we all see each other in the same way? And how do I interpret what my senses tell me? You might say that body odor is a pleasant smell, but I think it's a very bad smell. How do we interpret what our senses tell us? And then, of course, there's the issue that there's much more to you than I can know through the sensory. Which, of course, raises the question. Is there more to you than the sum total of your biological parts? And as Christians, we say yes. Well, how do I get to know you deeper than the sensory? Below that level or beyond that level. And here we begin to see now the problem of knowledge, especially as it relates to the gap factor. And I say it's true not just of people, it's true of all objects outside of ourselves. It's true within the biological realm itself. Science is trying to close that gap. And there are lots of problems epistemologically with that gap. Well, let's turn now to the historical development of epistemological thought and see how people have dealt with these issues through the ages. And of course, in a lecture over one evening, I have to make some huge generalizations. And if any of you are specialists in this subject, I'm going to irritate you enormously because I'm going to paint with a very broad brush. Whole epistemological systems have to be reduced to a few sentences tonight. What I hope to do through this overview is give you a picture of what has happened as people have wrestled with these issues and what options there are out there, because I want to show you that there's only really two big systems or options with respect to epistemology. So like all things which are very, very complex, at another level, everything's very, very simple. And it's true of this particular issue, too. I want to begin tonight with Plato. I'll be following this list down here on the left hand of my board. Plato was born in 428 BC, before Christ, and he is acknowledged to be among the greatest of Greek thinkers. Plato and Aristotle are usually put together. We'll touch Aristotle in a moment. Plato did some remarkable things in the world of ideas, and many have said that everything that's happened in philosophy since Plato and Aristotle are just footnotes of these two guys, and we'll see that as we go through this lecture. And I think out of the epistemology which Plato fashioned, there came a golden age. A golden age which lasted for hundreds of years. Because Plato created an epistemological paradise. He created a system of epistemology which was consistent and coherent. And that's why it attracted many for a number of years, but then we'll see why it began to be rejected. Now, this system that Plato created, we can call the triad. The triad, because there's a triangle here. There's three points in the triad. First of all, we have the idea up here. And this idea belongs to a transcendent or a spiritual realm. Then, down here in the left corner of the triad, you've got the subject, which for Plato was all about a memory which took place in the soul. I'll draw them to put these together in a moment. But the subject, and then you've got the object. I talked about this gap factor. These are the two points right here. How do you overcome it? And Plato said that in the triad, we overcome this gap factor. So this is the object or the particular. A lot of people, Plato did himself, talk about the chair as an example of the object. And this, for Plato, was the total system. There was nothing outside of this. This encompassed the whole system. It was total. Now, for Plato, there was a critical connection between all the points of this triangle, which made knowledge consistent and possible. First of all, there's a memory in the soul of the subject of what is in this world of ideas, in the supernatural, transcendent, spiritual realm. And this memory in the soul is called innate knowledge. It's innate. And it's there in us before we're born, Plato said. So it doesn't come out of our experience. You're just born with it, a certain innate knowledge. This chair here comes out of the world of ideas, is derived from the world of ideas, Plato said. So the connection between ideas here at the top of the triangle, the connection between the ideas here and the subject in the left-hand corner, where there's innate memories, and the connection between ideas here at the top and the chair in the right hand, bottom part of the triangle, the connection between these two things actually justify the connection between the subject and the object. And this is where it's epistemologically consistent. These two connections here justify this connection here. We can move across that gap because these two exist. That's what's taking place in the triad. And this triad has been developed in a number of different ways in terms of epistemological development within philosophy. The Stoics, who were actually around before Plato, but actually developed this whole idea in much more detail after him, took this triangle, they did something slightly different. At the top of this triangle, rather than idea, they had the idea of law or order. There was an imprint of order in another world within the realm of the transcendent.
I don't find that a lot. I see the connection between idea and subject. So there's an innate knowledge. I don't see a connection between idea and object. How does that relate?
Well, simply that the ideal chair belongs in this realm.
Is it a bit like the tabernacle Moses built? There was an idea of tabernacle in heaven, and he built just kind of the...
Well, it was an ideal in God's mind. So in an ideal world there, and it was passed on to Moses there. Now actually, in a moment, we'll see what Augustine did, that he made that exact connection. But here, anything that comes is in this world here, the world of particulars, the world of object, is derived out of this world of ideas.
Okay, so there's an ideal chair somewhere.
Absolutely. In another realm. So that makes this particular connection here. The Stoics just changed it by saying that up here you have law and order, and down here you have mind, rather than dwelling on memories and the soul. They dealt much more with just mind, pure mind. And they said the logos of mind corresponds to the structure of being, because both, again, come out of ideas. So that's what the Stoics did. I'm more interested in what Augustine did. Later on in the 4th and 5th century, Augustine used the same triangle to serve the cause of Christianity. And up here, Augustine had the divine mind. Mind. Down here is the subject in God's image. And then here you have the particular again. Now there's correspondence between the divine mind and the human mind, because Augustine pointed out rightly that we are created to think God's thoughts after him. So there's a connection there between divine mind and human mind. We created in the image of God. We were created to reflect him. So that creates that connection within this triangle. There's also a correspondence between the divine mind and the chair, because God created it. It comes from God. And that means there's a correspondence between the reliability of the human mind created in God's image and the stamp of the creator in creation, which is the chair. Everything within creation reflects God somehow because of this connection here. So the correspondence between this and this is again both linked to the divine mind. We think God's thoughts after him. God made the chair. So we can move from that corner to this corner again because of the top of the triangle. Now the question this begs, and we'll come back to this later, is how has the fall affected the reliability of the human mind? Now Augustine talked much about the fall, but in terms of his epistemology, he didn't actually deal very helpfully with the whole issue of how sin had affected the human mind. And that's where Augustine is criticized today by many thinkers, because they feel that he just took on Plato's triangle without incorporating fully enough Christian theology. Just a few more things to add with respect to the triad. We'll come back to it quite a few times through this lecture. Things that go with the triad that we need to keep in our minds. Firstly, if you have this epistemological system, you believe that there's a correspondence between thought and reality. That is how one views truth within this system. So you think, as you look out of the window, it's raining, as it has today. And within this system, you believe there's a real connection between that thought and the reality of the situation, that your thought is raining corresponds with the fact that it is raining. And that actually takes us very quickly one step further, and this is the second point, that language is just externalized thought. So if you say to someone, it is raining, that is a proposition. There's a correspondence between that statement, it is raining, and what's happening outside. So the idea in the mind, first of all, corresponds to the real, and in the form of a proposition, there's a connection between the idea and reality. So you've got this wonderful, smooth connection between idea, thought, word, and reality. Now, many of you might function like that every day of your lives, but if you read any modern philosophy, this is highly denied. Modern philosophy doesn't believe in these smooth connections anymore, in terms of the way human language functions. So that's a brief introduction to the triad. The second contender in the epistemological system we call the dyad. And the triad has always been challenged by the dyad. And these are the two competing systems that move through the history of philosophy. Now, the dyad is represented in the epistemological system of Aristotle. Aristotle was one of Plato's pupils, and he departed radically from Platonic ideas, kept some of them, but set up something quite different. And in Aristotle's epistemological system, there are only two points, the subject and the object. Now, any idea that we may have of a chair, and this is very true, that we symbolize a chair even if there's no chair in the room. So if you're walking in the Hampshire Downs, there's not a chair around, you still have an idea of a chair in your mind. Where did that idea come from? Well, Aristotle said this is simply formed after we've seen a certain number of chairs. So Hope now is at the point where she's taking in new sights constantly. Now she continues to take in those sights through her perception. She's going to form an idea in her mind of those sights, whether it be a chair or a dog or a rebellious student or whatever it is. So what you have is the subject who views the object, the chair, and that then goes back into the mind and gives us an idea of what a chair is. Now, in this system, you see that Aristotle did not believe that ideas had a separate existence of their own. And that means that ideas, or forms as he called them, are actually in the thing themselves. So the idea chair didn't predate the chair itself. So for Aristotle, ideas were not eternal. Plato said they're eternal. They've always existed. They existed before the particular chair. That's why the one comes from the other. Aristotle says no. There's nothing eternal about this. Our reason, our mind, our perception is empty until we sense the chair by means of the eyes, the perception. And so you see the two very, very different systems. In order to have epistemological certainty up in this system, you have to have the idea. You have to have another realm to make these connections. So this connection could be made along the bottom of the triangle. This doesn't have the third point. Aristotle was epistemologically optimistic still, but he said you don't need that upper point of the triangle for knowledge to take place. That between the subject and the object, true knowledge can be gained. Now this battle between the triad and the dyad is actually the history of epistemological thought. And when we move on into the Middle Ages, we see that it was the battle between the realists and the nominalists. The red line here represents the triad, those who are committed to the triad, the green, those the dyad. And here you see in the Middle Ages you had the realists who were committed to the triad and the nominalists who were committed to the dyad. The realists believed that ideas were real, that ideas had an independent existence. So, for instance, they believed, the realists, in an ideal justice. They believed in a justice which transcended the common experience of human beings. So there was an ideal justice out there, and most of these people were Christians. This ideal justice was something that God had determined. But it was an ideal outside of the system. So whenever we talk about justice and how we come to know it, we have to refer, the realist said, to this upper story here. But the nominalists rejected this, and many of these were Christians. They denied this triad, the Platonic triangle, and they were much more epistemologically pessimistic. And it's only in the Middle Ages that we see any pessimism. Some of the pre-Socratics have it, but a really, really strong epistemological pessimism in the history of theology, philosophy, I should say. Because the nominalist says there's no way that we can know if ideas exist independently. How can you prove that this realm exists? They say you can't. And because of that, the nominalist actually became very anti-metaphysical. Metaphysics is actually very concerned about this world up here, this transcendent world. It asks lots of questions of it. The nominalists didn't like that world at all, so they became anti-metaphysical. And they rejected all models. Metaphysicians love models. They didn't like models. The father of nominalism was William of Ockham, and he said, our knowledge must be based on the experience of individual things. Forget these fancy models. We've got to go down to the individual things. And Occam's razor is known, very well known in philosophy today. He says, it says, what can be done with fewer assumptions is done in vain with more. Keep it simple. It's the anti-model mentality. This just is too complicated. Keep it as simple as possible with the fewest number of assumptions. You're wasting your time if you use more. This brings us now to the Enlightenment. Much could and should be said about the Enlightenment, but I need to whip through this quickly. My particular view is that the Enlightenment, which was very much a reaction to the tribalism amongst Christians. Not very long after the Reformation took place, the beginning of the 16th century, we had the 30 Years' War in Europe. Many historians call this the Confessional Wars. And it was war between Christians who had differing theological positions. And there are many who feel that this actually led to a crisis of authority within the culture. And it was after this point that philosophy could no longer start with God. You start with God and it just ends up in war. So let's remove God from the system altogether and see where we can go with our knowledge claims then. Because up until the Enlightenment, most epistemologies had started with God. God was still in the picture. And many historians believe that actually the Enlightenment came out of the confessional wars. Whatever, we know this, that no longer would thinkers start with God at the point of the Enlightenment. Now, the epistemological battle during the Enlightenment was between the rationalists and the empiricists. And here again, we see the triad and the dyad at odds with each other. From the Enlightenment on, the empiricist would always have the upper hand, and the dyad has always been in the ascendancy since the point of the Enlightenment. And some of the key empiricists, I forgot to write them up here, would be Francis Bacon, Locke, Hobbes, ending with Hume, who really was an out-and-out skeptic. Now, these were the nominalists by tradition. All of these empiricists had given up on metaphysics. They were brought up within that way, but it had made them very skeptical about all knowledge claims. Metaphysics, which includes this realm here, had discouraged them enormously, so they became skeptics. And that's where they came to the place, starting with Locke, who formulated this, that the only things that we can know for sure is through the senses. That's what the empirical process is all about. The only thing we can know for sure is through the senses. And these guys were looking for a self-evident starting point. All of them were committed to the law of causality. The law of causality is simply this, that the whole of reality is connected through a chain of causes. This goes back to Aristotle's thought, key to the dyad in so many systems. That when you see an event, that event doesn't lie unconnected to other events. You see one event, you need to go back to its prior one. And everything within the whole of reality is connected by these chains of causality. And the empiricist says we can find those causes. We need to go looking for them with our senses through the application of science. Now, Locke actually believed that the mind was simply a blank sheet. You're not born with anything at all, total denial of anything innate within the human being. Our mind's just a blank sheet, and we don't impose anything on reality. But through our senses that we engage with reality, we simply receive back to the mind that which is true and reliable through our senses. That was the empirical method at its most optimistic. Later on, Hume, who became a total skeptic, really deconstructed empiricism. And he deeply influenced Kant, who was to follow shortly after. Because Hume actually pulled apart the whole law of causality. Causality is very much looking at what made this happen. So you engage with the empirical method, with your senses, the data before you, to find out causes. What are the causes of things? But Hume actually pulled apart this law, which undergirded the whole dyad. Because Hume made the point, which is daft at one point, but quite true on the other hand, is that we are not there to see something happen every time it happens. So take the pool table. And if you hit the eight ball at the same angle every single time, we would say that every single time it will shoot off at that particular angle. You hit it at that angle, it'll go off at that angle. There's a law of causality at work there. But Hume says we're not there to see causes happen every time. So you can't know for absolutely certain. There may be one time, remember epistemology is looking for absolute certainties. There may have been one time when that didn't happen. Or in the future, there may be one time when it doesn't happen. So you can't rest on the law of causality. And out of that, he became a radical skeptic about all knowledge claims. So during the Enlightenment, the empiricists, starting off very, very positive, followed this particular epistemological system. On the other hand, you had the rationalists. And Descartes is the best known of the Enlightenment rationalists. And he's very optimistic about epistemology. And actually, Descartes set out to defeat skepticism. Soon after the Enlightenment started, there was a lot of skepticism about. And Descartes says, we've got to overcome this. We've got to establish absolute principles of certainty that are undeniable. And what he's looking for is a foundation for epistemology that no one can deny, what we might call indubitable certainties. And he said, on these indubitable certainties, this one foundation, we have a starting point for all knowledge claims. And Descartes said, from there, from this foundation, then we can then move on to metaphysics. From this foundation of absolute knowledge, we can move to the existence of God, to morality, and so forth, all of which are metaphysical issues. Now, Descartes believed very strongly in the world of ideas. In fact, he started within that world. Descartes said, I think, therefore I am. So he was committed to the primacy of thought, to establishing a solid foundation for knowledge. So in that sense, Descartes functioned within the triad, within the triangle here. So through the Enlightenment, you've got this ongoing struggle between the rationalists and the empiricists. Then, in the Enlightenment, as the Enlightenment moves on, you've got Immanuel Kant, who is a very, very interesting figure, because Kant tries to combine both of these worlds. He's the only main philosopher who actually tried to bring the two of them together, to bring a synthesis here. Now, he's very much like Descartes in that he uses the thinking subject, right here, as the starting point. That's where Descartes started. I think, therefore I am. And I won't go into any more detail on all of this, otherwise we'll get bogged down. But the whole idea is that your starting point for an epistemological system is the subject. That's where Kant was also. Kant actually had very little interest in the real, in the object. He's actually very agnostic about this. In that sense, Kant is actually quite negative and pessimistic epistemologically. Kant's real interest is on how we process that which comes from the outside to us. How we process our interaction with the object. He says, actually, we have no real access to the object. All we have are streams of perception that come back and forth. So there's the object there, and streams of perception bombard us, bombard our senses. And because of those streams of perception, we know this is there. But we can't actually know it. And he's not that bothered about the it here. He's simply interested in what's happening with these streams of perception. Now, Kant actually believes, with Plato, in a kind of an innate knowledge, that there's inborn ideas within the subject. And he believed that we have a pre-programmed structure in our minds. But these pre-programmed structures in our mind are empty until there's a connection with the real. And he said that these pre-programmed structures, which are really categories in our thinking, that these categories without the sensory are empty. They're absolutely useless. But He said the sensory without the categories are mute. It's like a television that has no programs on it, just the white static on it. There's no coherence between the two. And he says when the pre-programmed structure in the mind connects with these perceptions of the sensory coming out of the real, then we have knowledge. But it has to go both ways. Now, actually, within this system, and this is in his critique of pure reason, he's just thinking of how reason functions. In this particular system here, Kant has no time at all for metaphysics. He has no time for God. Within his critique of pure reason, God doesn't exist. And what Kant does, therefore, is to come up with multiple rationalities. We don't just have pure mind, we have other ways, other types of reason too. And each of these types of reason in the human being has its own laws. Now, I'm actually quite sympathetic with Kant here in some respects. I've done a lot of work in imagination, on conscience. And in a sense, I'm happy to call these different types of reason at one level. But it's what Kant does with this which is intriguing. Because really, Kant, after he leaves pure reason behind and moves on to what he calls practical reason, why he brings up practical reason is because he wants to smuggle God back into the picture. Because Kant is a very devout man. Very devout, very religious. Now, practical reason is all about ethics. And Kant saw that without God, ethics would make no sense at all. And that's because good has to be rewarded, according to Kant, and evil has to be punished. He lives within an ordered universe in his mind. But he says this doesn't actually happen in this world. You don't always see good rewarded and evil punished. So therefore, he said, there must be an afterlife. And he actually tried to prove this through practical reason. He tried to prove the existence of the afterlife, which is actually somewhat within this triangle again, moving into the world of metaphysics. And then he actually talked about an ascetic mind. You've got the pure mind, you've got the practical mind, you've got the ascetic mind. And through the ascetic mind, we make judgments about beauty. We look at cultures, we look at art. And so for Kant, there was these various minds. But basically, he's trying to bring these two systems together. He's critiquing both and try to make a synthesis of them, which makes sense of epistemology, how we come to knowledge claims. Next, moving on from Kant, we have Hegel. And Hegel really made the last attempt to heal the gap between the subject and the object. And many call him the last great philosopher of the Platonic realist tradition. The last one to really work to maintain the triad. Hegel was someone who was very epistemologically optimistic. You see a lot of pessimism in Kant. He's not really concerned anymore about the object. He's much more selfward in its focus. Descartes was, for that matter, too. He starts with the I. He's the first narcissist of the modern world. Kant has the same thing. He's just interested in how we process what comes to us through our perceptions. He's lost more and more interest in the object outside of himself. But Hegel steps back from all of this, and he's very epistemologically positive. He says, no, we can know. We can know for certainty. And he was not going to abandon man's distinctive, essential rationality. Kant tried to critique that, his critique of pure reason. But Hegel wouldn't do that. And he believed very much in the world of ideas. And for Hegel, the connections, and he worked purely within this triad, in a very pure way, the connection between every part of the triangle were so tight and so great that actually they're almost the same thing. And many people feel that Hegel's philosophy was actually a form of pantheism. That the connections there are so tight that he makes all of this one. And he said that as we become one with ideas, we become one with the whole of reality, that which is outside of us, the object here. And he talked about when this oneness taking place, that our egoism and our selfishness just melt away in our consciousness of being. So the sense of oneself as self disappears within Hegel's particular triad. Now, Hegel's methodology was known as the dialectic. This is a conjunction of opposites from which a synthesis emerges. You've got something on this side, and you've got an antithesis on this side. If these two clash and come into conflict with each other, it forms a synthesis which resolves this particular conflict. And he said this is how the whole of reality works. And this is, in a rational sense, how we solve all apparent contradictions. And he said, the dialectic in epistemology gives us logical certainties. There are apparent contradictions there, but actually, in the clash, the dialectic, the clash between the thesis and the antithesis, we come up with something new, which resolves that particular tension. So it's very positive about how we can come up with our knowledge claims. Now, Hegel's thinking was extremely influential on those who came after him. And basically, the thinkers that came after Hegel went in two very different directions. There are those who are known as the left Hegelians, and they actually kept Hegel's methodology, but they had this terrible fear that Hegel was just trapped in a spiritual world, a world of pure ideas. He thought this is where true being was found. So these left Hegelians actually rejected the spiritual altogether and said that the essence of being is found in nature. It's found in the material worlds. So they're still within the triad, but the essence of nature is found now purely in materialism. And these people use the dialectic then in a very materialistic way. And this actually ended up with Marxism. Marxism came out of this particular system. And the oneness that's going to be sought for within the materialist dialectic was in the obliteration of the class conflict. So that's where one side of the Hegelian followers went. The others, known as the right Hegelians, continued with the idealism of Hegel, this world of pure ideas, and many of these became mystical. And historians tell us that these right Hegelians actually were the forerunners of German Romanticism. That there were those who followed the system who were Christians, and these actually became caught up with ideas to a degree where they started to create perfect theological systems. And I've got many systematic theologies in my bookcase, which probably go back to these right Hegelians, making perfect theological systems in the world of ideas. But it all came out of the Hegelian methodology. Well, following on from Hegel, we come to Kierkegaard. And we need to know that Kierkegaard was very much reacting against the legacy left by Hegel. And Kierkegaard cannot handle the triangle at all. And he's actually on somewhat of a crusade against all neat systems and ideologies. He hates systems and ideologies. And he basically wants to deconstruct all of them. And he often stresses in his writings that we have no direct and immediate connection to reality. This gap exists, and that's just a fact of life, he says. And this makes the human, the subject, just a lonely subject, as he called them. And we cannot know anything for certain. So Kierkegaard is very pessimistic, epistemologically. He's pessimistic about what we can know. Now, where the old divide in philosophy was usually between the good and the evil, good and bad, for Kierkegaard it's between being authentic and being just part of the crowd. To be just part of the crowd is to be non-existent. And now we begin to understand why so many people are taking with Kierkegaard today. Authenticity, on the one side of the divide, non-existence, just being part of the crowd, on the other. And Kierkegaard stressed that we have to exit from the crowd. Now, for him, that was the Danish Lutheran Church. But whatever it is, if we're just part of the crowd, we are in a type of non-existence. We have to exit out of that. And he said, when we come out of the crowd, it's there that we have our encounter with God. And only then do we become truly authentic. We become existing creatures. And he talked lots about how God calls us out of the crowd to authentic existence. He calls us out of the crowd to an encounter with him, and we have to respond to that call. And he said, we do this through a leap of faith. Remember, we cannot know anything for sure, so we just have to exit from the crowd. That's all we have to do. And one of the reasons Kierkegaard hated the triangle so much, because there is no room for a leap of faith here. It's all too smooth. It's all too consistent. Now, Kierkegaard wasn't really a philosopher, and what he wrote is not really a philosophy, it's more of a mood, as many have said. And he's simply arguing against something. He's the first deconstructionist. He wants to tear something down. And actually, Kierkegaard was very psychological in his orientation. He wanted to know how the self functioned. That's his particular interest. Well, after Kierkegaard, we have Rudy, can you pronounce it correctly for me? Schleiermacher. Okay, Schleiermacher. Now, Schleiermacher is really more of a theologian than he was a philosopher. And as a theologian, he's actually a self-styled apologist. And Schleiermacher is trying to rescue Christianity from skepticism. So he's trying to do Christianity a good turn. Now, it's interesting that Schleiermacher is, in many respects, seen to be the leader of German Romanticism. And he's also known within theology as the father of liberalism. Now, between German Romanticism and higher critical liberalism, we've got a bad package there. This is not a good dude, a good chap. We have to understand what he's trying to do. Like Kierkegaard, here's someone who's not happy with neat systems. We'll get to that later. It's not really part of this lecture either. But we can, he does not like systems, so therefore he has a huge problem with the triad. And again, like Kierkegaard and like Kant, Schleiermacher is arguing for the separation of the subject and the object. And also like Kant, he reaffirms multiple rationalities. Now, where Kant stressed it over against pure reason, you had practical reason, which dealt with issues of morality. Schleiermacher said that the other side of pure reason isn't morality, it's feelings and inner experience. And there you have Schleiermacher in the palm of your hand. On the other side of pure reason, you don't have morality, you have feelings and inner experience. And he stressed that religious people don't need to be worried about philosophy and science. These belong in another box. In that sense, he's a pietist. Don't deal with philosophy and science because they belong in that box. We belong in this particular box. And in our box, we're concerned about feeling and inner experience. And that's what the box of religion is all about. And he says Christians should stay in this box and not worry about the other boxes. Now, in doing this, he made Christianity not public truth. He made it all about inner experience. And if we look at much Christianity today, we say, where does the legacy come from? Christianity is not public truth. What does it have to say to politics and to what's happening in the world of art today? You know, it's not about public truth. It's just about a privately engaging experience. Privately engaging, publicly irrelevant, as one well-known sociologist put it. So that's Schleiermacher. Next, we move on to Nietzsche. Now, in many respects, Nietzsche is similar to Kierkegaard. He's anti-metaphysical, and he despises ideas. Nietzsche, however, took his program direction from Kierkegaard. He took it away from Christianity. There is much about Kierkegaard that I admire in my reading of him, but I still feel that he's a very, very dangerous influence. But in terms of what he's intending to do, he's intending to bring us to God. So in that sense, he's in line with what Christianity is all about. Nietzsche is a self-styled antichrist. He wants to bring it in the opposite, to take us in the opposite direction. Nietzsche is someone who believed that all human knowledge is situational. This is known as perspectivism. That all of our knowledge is conditioned by the particularities of our human existence. If you were brought up as a Muslim, you'll be a Muslim. If you were brought up as a Lutheran, you'll be a Lutheran. If you're brought up as an atheist, you'll be an atheist. So all the knowledge we have is conditioned by the particularities of our human existence. Perspectivism. So again, in Nietzsche's thinking, the human being is the lonely subject. And he says we have to exit or exist out of the conditioning of our context. This is, again, the out-of-the-crowd phenomenon. And he says we can only exit out of this conditioning of our context by means of the will to power. He says it's better to condition than to be conditioned. And you can only condition if you do it from the place of power. Don't let others condition you. You condition others. It's impossible to avoid it. Someone's going to be conditioned. But by the will to a power, you can exit out of the crowd. You can be Superman, and you can begin to be an existing person. Again, Nietzsche, not so much the creator of a philosophy. He's more, again, a psychologist. He's reflecting a mood And because of that, he, like Kierkegaard, is extremely influential today. Let's try to move quickly now to the 20th century. What we see in the 20th century is a separation, a radical separation between natural science and the humanities. Now, before the 20th century, these two were not as disconnected as they've become in the 20th century. Freud thought that he was doing hard science, and he was passionate about that. But moving into the 20th century, there's this radical divide between natural science and the humanities. Firstly, natural science. Natural science in the 20th century has been in the empiricist tradition, following Aristotle, and it works with that which is verifiable through the scientific method. Now, science in the empiricist tradition has no real metaphysic, so it's not in the triangle, so it doesn't deal with questions of meaning. Science this century hasn't dealt with questions of meaning. But that doesn't matter too much, because natural science works. It has wonderful applications in technologies, which greatly enhance our lives and make us much more comfortable. So even though it doesn't give us any metaphysical answers, it does make life very, very comfortable for us. So we don't need to be too concerned about the lack of metaphysics. And the progress of science this century has seemed unstoppable, one giant leap after the other. And what all this means is that this century's science has become the safe island of epistemology. It's within science that you have certainties. It's in science that you have truth. On the other hand, you've got the humanities. And the humanities are simply conditioned by our subjectivity, and therefore they're not true science. They're not part of the safe island. Knowledge within the humanities is relative and it's conditioned. We define the data we're using, and in the process, the data defines us. And actually, within the humanities, pluralism and relativism are almost necessary. You don't have hard fact anymore in the humanities. It only exists within the sciences. Now, in the last 50 years, thinkers within philosophy have focused on this island of truth, which is left in the natural sciences. This is the last safe island for epistemology, for epistemological certainty. And the question these thinkers have asked is this: is it really so safe? And can we be so sure epistemologically about what science verifies? And it's in this period that the philosophy of science has come into being. It's a very new discipline. And this philosophy of science has largely attacked the safe island of epistemology within the natural sciences. Here you've got Kuhn, Popper, and Polanyi as the major thinkers. Kuhn comes along and demonstrates that science has prior commitments. And when you engage in science, you always use models. Models are formed out of your experiments. So you experiment with the data, and out of this data, you form a model. And this becomes even more necessary as we move into the 20th century, because we're increasingly working on the level of the micro and the macro, the level of the atomic, which you can't see. So you have to create models. At the level of the cosmic, the astro, that which is getting too big for us to see properly, so we have to start working more and more with models. Now, Kuhn says we're constantly experiencing what he called cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance is the friction between the model and the reality we're working with, because these two never fit together perfectly in harmony. They might for the moment that you create the model, but you do more experimentation and suddenly there's a friction there between your experiment and the model you create out of your experiment. And this rubbing together of the model and your data from the experience creates what he called a paradigm shift. This is caused by the inertia of the friction. Paradigm shift. So out of this cognitive dissonance between model and the facts, there's a certain energy there, so you create a new model. You shift your model. There's a paradigm shift that takes place. And what he begins to demonstrate is that the so-called safe island of natural science is actually in constant flow and movement. Then you've got Popper, Karl Popper. Now, Popper said that all the scientist has is fact, or datum, as he called it. And these facts have to be organized into some kind of pattern and a hypothesis, or a model, to use Kuhn's phrase. And these facts of science, that's all a scientist has to work with, are mute or useless until they're worked into a scientific theory. So we're constantly having to work with theories or models. And Popper says that these models can be formed through all sorts of channels and means. He said you can actually form your models using imagination. You've got the facts there before you, but you need to create a model. How do you do it? He says, use imagination. Popper even went so far to say, get it out of a dream if you want. But get the model any way you can. Something that works with the datum. It kind of makes sense of it. But the fact is, the model is not real. It's not objective. It's just a way of coping with the facts. And he stated, again in line with Kuhn, that we're constantly going to have to change the model in order to incorporate new datum. And that is why these models never achieve the status of objective truth. They're always going to be changing. And he also said that the direction of the change is enlargement. He was a modernist. He believed in progress, that we'll get bigger and better models. But they're always models, and therefore they're not certainties. And then you have Polanyi, and I'm going to speak about him at some length next week. He fascinates me very much. Polanyi is someone who said that every theory has to have a commitment to a starting point. And he called this a faith commitment. And he's the one who said that faith is as integral to science as it is to religion. You go back to the empiricists, go back to Locke, and he said faith is something which falls short of a certainty. Polanyi says, no. All of our science claims rest on faith. Faith is integral to the science enterprise. And he went on and said that science also involves an interpretive process. To create a model with your data is to be involved in a creative process. It's creative. Remember, Popper said, use your imagination. Use dreams if you want. And this means that science is not so different from art. If you went to university, you had your arts, the arts part of your university, you had the science part of your university. And these two, never the two shall meet. My university, we wrote a play about the conflict between these two things. But Polanyi said, you're not that different from each other. Now you take these three together, and you effectively have the destruction of the last island of truth in the natural sciences. And that's where we've come to today. Many still act as though science gives you objective truth, but actually within the discipline itself, within the realm of epistemology, no one, especially because of these three, feel that natural science gives you objective truth. But that doesn't mean we're not committed to science, and that these people aren't committed to science. And we're always going to be committed to science for very pragmatic reasons. Because science is vital in terms of its application to technology. Technology making our lives better, happier, more comfortable, and so forth. So it doesn't really matter if science is an objective truth. If it makes us more comfortable, if it works, there's the pragmatic dimension of it, that's fine, we'll keep it. But the fact is, science is no longer the way to objective truth, as it was perceived back in the 19th century. If you could have asked a Victorian, what is truth, they would have said science. Science is truth. And I'm saying at the end of our century, there are still some who say that, but very few. No longer is science truth. Now this has left philosophy with one last thing to look at in terms of epistemological certainty, and this is the whole issue of language. And that's these three things right here. And the last 40 years has seen an enormous amount of attention given to the issue of language. Is language actually capable of delivering certainties in the realm of knowledge? We've pretty well given up on science, but what about language? How does language function? Is there any certainties there? Now remember, within the triad, language is externalized thought. And there's a smooth connection, I said, between thought, language, and external reality. So if you work within this system, you are basically positive about the reliability of language. Language is reliable. Now, the nominalists are not so positive about language. Language is simply, for the nominalists, even of the Middle Age, language is simply a convention. And language is all about consensus. That means objects can be renamed. And, of course, there's a certain truth to that. But the stress is that language is not fixed, it's situated. Now, if you take that conclusion to its end, you lose absolutely everything. And that's what's happened today. Think about it. Science, theology, philosophy is all mediated through language. Now, if language is completely situated, it's undetermined and it's loose, then it makes no sense to engage with any of these disciplines. I think that's part of the reason why more and more people are very skeptical about science, theology, and philosophy. It's just language games. And language is situated. There's nothing fixed about it. Now, we come to logical positivism. And logical positivism attempted to come to the rescue here. They're quite prescient. They saw ahead. They saw where things were going. They said, we've got to retain language, the verifiability of language. In a sense, this was the last hope for language. And it worked within empirical science again, back in the 50s, 40s, 50s. And it went like this, that if you have an exact description of an experiment, plus laws of formal logic, you'll get something solid in language, something that is fixed and determined. And the early Wittgenstein said that this was the last resort for objective truth. We have to nail down something solid in language. That's what logical positivism is trying to do. He said everything else is poetry. It's nice, but it's meaningless because it's not verifiable. So we have to work with language so we see that we've got something absolutely fixed. No one can deny it. And they thought there was an empirical method by which that could be done. Now, logical positivism didn't last long. It was soon deconstructed because not everything is in the lab. Empiricism is dealing with what is in the lab. You use your senses. But you don't have everything in the lab here because you have to use statements of language which come from outside of the lab. That's why it didn't last long. This is very obvious. There is no such thing as pure scientific discourse. You have to use descriptive adjectives. Action, adverbs, which come from outside of the lab in order to describe what's going on. You can't keep everything in the lab, and that's why it quickly ran aground. You couldn't keep it together. The language has come under increasing attack, as I've said, as the century moved on. The modern structuralists, as we call them, tried to rescue the objectivity of language also. What they did is looked at the artifacts of many different cultures in our world. They looked at the different literature that comes from different cultures, the various symbols that were used in its art and music and so forth. And they said that if we look at all these artifacts, we can discover in them universal patterns, structures. And these patterns are structures that can then be related to the human brain. And they said, we'll see then that there's a commonality across the world in the way we use signifiers. There's something fixed and structured within language. If we simply use the data before us, the artifacts of various cultures. So these people were very positive about language. But then, after the structuralists, came the post-structuralists. Lyotard, Foucault, and Derrida. And I don't want to spend more than 30 seconds talking about these guys, because everyone talks about them today. These guys were all about deconstructing the structures in the data of various authors. They said that any system of classification is just another imposed structure. It's just a power play. It's just a game. It's simply a way of imposing an agenda. These structuralists think they're working with something which is fixed. They're not. They're just imposing something onto these artifacts. There's nothing solid you can get out. Again, they became very, very pessimistic with respect to epistemology. And so with these guys, we reach the total epistemological despair of our present moment. And this is the air that all of you guys breathe today. You might never have heard of any of these theories, especially these later ones here through the 20th century. But that's what you live and breathe every moment of your existence. And that's why so many of you are so negative and pessimistic about what you can know. This has led to the extreme epistemological pessimism which is around today. Let me make some concluding remarks. I've covered so much, just sound bites in a sense, but to try and give you a picture of where things have gone. In terms of a conclusion, I'm not going to construct a neat biblical epistemological model or system that's going to set all the problems to rights once and for all. A I simply want to draw a few brief conclusions that relate to the two main epistemological systems, the triad and the dyad. And I want to argue here for the triad as an authentic and true system when handled in an appropriate manner. And I argue for this simply because I believe in ideas. I believe in metaphysics. And in that sense, I'm a bit of a dinosaur today. Within philosophy, you meet very few people who take metaphysics seriously in terms of epistemology because they don't believe in the world of ideas. They don't believe that ideas have an independent existence apart from nature. Let me just state very briefly, and these are just conclusions, so much more needs to be drawn out of them, but just stated conclusions. I want to conclude with why the dyad must be rejected. Why the dyad must be rejected. And firstly, following on from what I've just said, because ideas are real. Ideas are real, so therefore, so is the triad. This exists. I believe in a realm of reality which is separate to the subject and to material, object materiality. And I believe in a realm which is part of what C.S. Lewis called supernature, the world of ideas. Ideas are not just part of the interlocking system of nature. Many within the dyad talked about a sort of idea, but it was just interlocked within this system. So it wasn't ideas with a capital I, it was ideas with a small I. And I believe that ideas exist independently of these two lines, these two points right here in the triangle. I believe that ideas belong to a spiritual world. It's part of the reality of the supernatural. If we are thoroughgoing supernaturalists, it shouldn't be hard to believe in ideas. This belongs to the transcendent realm. And that's why it's possible to think reality and not touch it. And every time I think about reality in my mind, I'm entering a supernatural spiritual world. That's why I get excited by lunch discussions. And so many of you are bored to tears. We're entering a real world, a supernatural world, a spiritual world, a world of ideas. We enter that world. And it's the existence of this realm that makes the third point in the epistemological triangle. And this provides the necessary link to epistemological coherence and consistency. You need these three if you're going to be positive and optimistic epistemologically. Now, I haven't given a proof for this. Now, I don't think there is an ultimate proof. We'll get to that next week, the relationship between faith and reason. I'm just saying why I think this has to be rejected, because ideas are real, not part of the interlocking system of nature. Secondly, the dyad has to be rejected because the dyad always leads to radical skepticism. Always. And that's why I outlined this historical overview here. We see from the Enlightenment where empiricism has led us. Right into the 20th century with this and then this, the philosophy of science, and then this whole debate over language. So we've reached the total despair, epistemological despair, at the end of the 20th century because of this dyad. We've lacked this point of the triangle. And as Schaeffer often said, man starting from himself is not a sufficient basis for knowledge. It's not sufficient. And within this system of the dyad, we can never bridge the gap between subject and object. And very soon after the Enlightenment took place, Kant said, forget about this. It doesn't even matter. We can't get near it. If nothing transcends the knower, and that's what ideas do, we are doomed to epistemological pessimism. And remember this, if we reject ideas, we reject metaphysics. And it's only within metaphysics that we can talk about meaning coherently. So it's so important that we retain ideas. Finally, some cautionary notes about the triad. I am not a Platonist. I have huge problems with Platonism. So some cautionary notes about the triad. Firstly, ideas must always be connected to an infinite personal God. Always. Ideas do not exist apart from God. Nothing exists apart from God. And when we deal with ideas, we deal with something that reflect and symbolize God. Every part of creation points to Him. Now that's actually part of this triad idea, everything pointing to, reflecting. Ideas reflect and symbolize God. I believe ideas are spiritual. They're not part of the interlocking system of nature. Well, that points to God. God is spiritual. It also reminds us that God is rational. God is coherent in the way he thinks. Now, of course, lying underneath all of this is the fact that he is personal. So many triad systems have left the idea impersonal, just left it with that. But we say, no, God is personal. And all this means that ideas themselves are never supreme. With Plato, they were supreme. They were the top thing. But we say, no, they're not supreme. They always point to something greater. And ultimately, ideas point to the fact that God is incomprehensible. A Christian triad has lots of room for mystery. Ideas themselves point to the fact that God is incomprehensible. And that means that the triangle is not the total system. That's the problem with the triad in philosophy. It's the total system. There's nothing outside of that triangle. We have to reject that. You see, the triangle as Plato conceived it makes such tight connections between the three points of the triangle that you have the whole system with God inside. And that's why Hegel became a pantheist. With God inside this, you inevitably end up with a type of pantheism. And in philosophy, when you haven't had a God who exists outside of the system, this epistemological system will always lead to pantheism. So that's why without a personal infinite God who exists inside and outside of the triangle, you always end up with monism. You also end up with a system that has no room for mystery. And that's why so many react against the system. The neat, cute thing that Kierkegaard was reacting against. Secondly, cautionary note, as we engage with ideas, we must always factor in the impact of the fall on the human mind. That's where I think Augustine went wrong. We have to factor in the impact of the fall, Genesis 3, on the human mind. Romans 1 reminds us that there is enough evidence in creation to lead us to the conclusion that God is. There's enough evidence there. But, Paul says, we suppress that evidence. We don't deal with the obvious. And that's because as human beings under the fall, we live in a lie. And we live in a lie because there's something wrong with the way the mind works. We are not self-sufficient in our human mind to find God. There's something wrong with the mind. And that is why any tribe that fails to show how biblical revelation is essential to the true idea is completely faulty. If the top point of the triangle fails to be informed by revelation, there can be no epistemological coherence and correspondence because the human mind is faulty. It doesn't mean it's completely scrambled. I have a place for natural theology. We can come to truth like Plato and Aristotle did, by means of the human mind. But there's something wrong with it. It's damaged. It doesn't go far enough. And we need enlightening in the world of ideas by a God who stands outside the system and sees it as it is. And he says, this is the truth. You're in a lie. This is the truth. And that's what I want to take up next week, take up these particular points that I've left in terms of my conclusion. Let me stop there.